This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Kris Kristofferson, just turned 70. But the summer of 2006 is turning out to be a very busy period for him. Last week, he was honored with the Johnny Mercer Award from the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Next month, he'll get his hands in cement at the Hollywood Walk of Fame. There's a new tribute album, The Pilgrim, a celebration of Kris Kristofferson, with other artists performing his songs. And Kristofferson himself has a new studio album out called This Old Road.
Am I young enough to believe in revolution? Am I strong enough to get down on my knees and pray? And am I high enough on the chain of evolution to respect myself and my brother and my sister and perfect myself in my own peculiar way? I get lazy and forget my obligations. I'd go crazy if I paid attention all the time. And I want justice, but I'll settle for some mercy on this holy road through the universal mind. Am I young enough to believe in revolution?
Kristofferson entered the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2004 for writing such songs, some of them crossover hits, as Me and Bobby McGee, For the Good Times, From the Bottle to the Bottom, and Help Me Make It Through the Night. Kristofferson arrived in Nashville in the 60s after living in England as a Rhodes Scholar and serving in the military. His first job in the music industry was working as a janitor at Columbia Records. It was there that he met Johnny Cash, who became his good friend, recorded Kristofferson's songs, and convinced Kristofferson to start recording himself. Kristofferson is as well known for his acting as his singing. His films include Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, A Star is Born, Lone Star, Payback, and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Terry spoke with Kris Kristofferson in 1999. Let's get started with his best-known song, Me and Bobby McGee.
If it sounds country, man, that's what it is. It's a country song. Yeah, okay. Well, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Busted flat in Baton Rouge and heading for the trains. Feeling nearly faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained. Took us all away to New Orleans. I took my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana and was blowing sad while Bobby sang the blues. With them windshield wipers slapping time and Bobby clapping hands, we finally sang a velvet song that driver knew. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and Bobby McGee.
The most famous line from the song is "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." What inspired that line?
Well, that's what the song was really about to me. Was the double-edged sword, you know, that freedom is. And when I wrote that, some of my songwriter friends in Nashville told me to take it out of the song, said it was that it didn't fit, that it, the rest of the imagery was so real and concrete that it was out of place to put a little philosophical line in there.
Tell me if I remember correctly, did you have a house that burned down at about the time you wrote this song?
No, No, I had had. I tell you what, I had. I was living in a condemned building at the time, and in a thing that cost me, I think, $50 a month, and somebody had broken into it during the week that I was down in the Gulf of Mexico, and trashed the place and stole what little I had to steal. I remember it was a very liberating feeling to me because everything was gone, and there was nowhere to go but up. I had also alienated my family at the time. My wife had left me, and I was separated, you know, from my kids. And I think I'd been disowned by my parents by that time. And it was pretty liberating not having any expectations or anything to live up to.
How did Janis Joplin end up recording this song?
Bobby Newirth taught Janis the song, I believe. And I think he'd heard it when Roger Miller had recorded it. Mm-hmm. I first heard that she had sung this song when I came back from, I'd been down in Peru making a movie with Dennis Hopper, singing Bobby McGee, as a matter of fact, in the film. And somebody told me she had sung it in a concert, I think it was in Nashville. And then later, Bobby introduced me to her, and we lived out of her house for about a month or so. And we became close friends, but I never did hear her sing it. I never heard her tape of it till the day after she died. Paul Rothschild played it for me.
What year did you first get to Nashville, and what was it like when you got there?
I first went there in June of 1965, and was on my way back from a 3-year tour in the Army in Germany, and was on my way to the career course down at Fort Benning, and from there to supposedly to teach English at literature at West Point. And since my military obligation was already fulfilled, I decided I was going to get out of the Army and be a songwriter. I had spent a couple weeks there just on tour. I mean, just, you know, I was on leave and got shown around to some of the songwriter sessions and got a glimpse of the life. I've always felt like I was really lucky to have been exposed to Nashville at that time, because I'm sure it's different now.
There must have been some kind of life-changing thought that happened to you since you'd been on this military career track. Your father had been a military career man. Was it a sudden change of heart or what that made you think, I'm not going to teach at West Point, I'm going to try writing songs in Nashville?
Well, I had never intended to make the military career or the academic life. I always thought that I hoped that I would be a writer and be able to have a creative life, you know. And then, well, after I graduated from college, I went to Oxford for a couple of years, and then I went in the military for almost 5 years. And by that time, I had a family and, you know, a wife and a daughter, and I think I sort of despaired of ever making my living as an artist until I went to Nashville. I went there because my last year in the Army over in Germany, I'd formed a band and started writing songs again. I'd been writing songs all my life, but started really escaping into it during the last year I was over there in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And went to Nashville to try to peddle the songs. And then when I got there, it was so different from any life that I'd been in before, just hanging out with these people who stayed up for 3 or 4 days at a time, you know, nights, and were writing songs all the time. I think I wrote four songs during the first week I was there.
Hmm.
And it was just so exciting to me. It was like a lifeboat, you know? It was like my salvation.
Kris Kristofferson speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. His new CD is called This Old Road. There's also a tribute CD featuring other country artists doing his songs called The Pilgrim. Here's Willie Nelson singing Kristofferson's song, The Legend.
Was it better then, with our backs against the wall? Were we better men than we'd ever been before? Say, if she came again today, would you still answer to the call? Tell the truth, my friend, don't it matter anymore? We were simple men by her side when she was born. Simple then, like the freedom when you fall. And we were smaller than you see, but soon we gathered like a...
We'll continue our interview with Kris Kristofferson after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1999 interview with Kris Kristofferson. His new CD is called This Old Road.
How did you start making movies? Did you think, one day I'm going to act?
When I started performing my own songs, my first, the first place I ever played was at the Troubadour Club in Los Angeles. It was kind of a hangout like the Bitter End in New York. And I think at the time, There was more people looking for new blood, because I got a lot of offers just off of performing there. And eventually Harry Dean Stanton gave me a script. I didn't even know he was an actor at the time. I thought he just sang in the bar there at the Troubadour. But he helped me do a screen test for a film that was called Cisco Pike, and I got to put my music in it, and I was the lead in it, in a film with Gene Hackman and Karen Black and Harry Dean, and just went on from there.
Compare the roles that you get now with what you got early on. You're often playing the heavy now.
Yeah, I think that's thanks to John Sayles.
And Lone Star.
In Lone Star, yeah.
Yeah, where you played a sadistic sheriff.
Yeah, it was so different from most of the roles that I played before that I think people finally thought I was acting. I'm not sure anybody thought I'd ever acted before that.
Well, I thought I'd play a short scene from Payback. And in this movie, Mel Gibson is a con man who's getting revenge on the people who conned him out of $70,000 and also shot him and left him for dead. You play somebody who heads a crime syndicate, and Mel Gibson has kidnapped your son and is holding him hostage until you deliver the $70,000. But now you've got Mel Gibson tied up, and you're trying to get him to tell you where he's holding your son. And here you are threatening him.
Here it is. 130,000. That's as close as you're ever going to get to it. But I'll make you a deal. Tell me where John is and I'll finish you quick. I promise you won't have to find out what your left ball tastes like. But if there's even a bruise on him, I'll make this last 3 weeks. I'll give you a blood transfusion to keep you alive if I have to. Where is he?
That's Kris Kristofferson in a scene from Payback. How'd you get this part?
Well, they had actually finished the film and apparently weren't satisfied with the way it worked. And they created this character for me to play. And I went in and shot a week. And I told Mel, I said, yeah, there's not any pressure on me. The whole film doesn't work, and you're expecting me to repair it in a week. But I think I got it because of playing Charlie Wade, you know, in The Lone Star.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine it's a lot of fun to be in a movie like this in which there's a lot of really good, snappy, hard-boiled writing. It's a really well-written and directed film.
Yeah.
It also must be fun to be terrorizing Mel Gibson.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It was so late at night when we did that. I my brain sort of locked up there for a while, and I can remember he was sitting. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and he was sitting there. It was painfully in the chair while the guy was smashing his toes with a hammer. And I sort of just, my brain was paralyzed for a moment there. I said, you know, this usually happens to me about once in every film. I get to a point where I just can't imagine that I'll ever act in anything again, that I find myself uniquely unequipped to be an actor. I says, but usually it takes longer to get to it than this. This was my first night.
Did people panic when you said that?
Not really. I don't think anybody was afraid that I couldn't do it.
Well, I'd like to close with another song from the Austin Sessions. And this is a song called The Pilgrim, Chapter 33. Now, this song is quoted in Taxi Driver. The Sybil Shepherd character, Betsy, buys the record for Travis, the taxi driver played by Robert De Niro, and she says that he reminds her of the character in the song, and she quotes the line, he's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction. How did the song end up in Taxi Driver?
I don't know. I always felt like that was the nicest thing that Marty Scorsese ever did to me.
Well, I guess you had already worked with him, and Alice doesn't live here anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, but I didn't know it was going to be in that one, and God, he had, there's De Niro holding up my album, and they're quoting me like Bob Dylan or something. It was. I still think that's one of the sweetest things I've ever seen anybody do for anybody in the business.
And who did you write the song about?
Well, I wrote it about myself and about a lot of friends of mine that I thought were, you know, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Chris Gantry, and Johnny Cash, and everybody I knew at the time. And a lot of us were 33 at the time. That's why it's called Chapter 33. And Dennis Hopper. I remember when we were down in Peru, every time that you would tell somebody you were 33 years old, they'd say, oh, the age of Christ. So that sort of fit the pattern of it.
So were you referring at all to how you and a lot of people you knew were kind of self-invented?
Oh, yes. Yes. Partly truth and partly fiction. You know, I've always felt I and many of the people I admire are figments of our own imagination. I always felt that Willie Nelson, Muhammad Ali, were particularly successful at that, at imagining themselves and living up to what they imagined themselves to be. When I first saw Muhammad Ali, he was Cassius Clay. He was a little skinny, light heavyweight over in Rome. And he was telling everybody he was going to be the biggest, the best. You know, he was the next Joe Louis. And he imagined himself right up into that.
Did you feel and you did that too?
I think I did. When I think back to when I first was writing my first songs, you know, like when I was 11 years old down in Brownsville, Texas, I think that I imagined myself into a pretty full life after that. I was certainly not equipped by God to be a football player, but I got to be one. And I got to be a ranger and a paratrooper and a helicopter pilot, you know, and a boxer and a lot of things that I don't think I was built to do. I just imagined them.
Kris Kristofferson and Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air.